When systems analysis is our only approach to a catastrophe of this sort, it becomes one more way we allow the logic of institutions, which is about self-preservation, to overwhelm the logic of the human heart, which is about love and duty. In the process, systems analysis can contribute to the long-term decline of compassion, responsibility, and courage in our culture. As I read the case study, trying to bring it down to human scale, two details caught my eye. First, at the time of the donor's death, a surgical resident with only 12 days of experience in the transplant institute had been left alone to attend to this man, along with 34 other intensive care patients, during a critical 3-hour period when the donor developed serious symptoms. Clearly, the resident could not give her charges the attention they required, and later described herself, in what must be an understatement, as feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility of caring for so many patients. Second, the donor's wife was at the hospital during the entire post-operative period, attempting to advocate for her husband. Her description of his final hours is heart-wrenching. "I was present while my husband coughed up blood for 2 hours before he finally choked on it and died. I begged for attention to his condition and got none." I think often about this woman and the nightmare she endured, a nightmare she lives with to this day. I think also about the young resident who was abandoned by her colleagues during that critical time, and I have empathy for her as well. Surely she was left with a nightmare of her own. But a moral response to this catastrophe ends neither in personal empathy nor in the penalties the New York State Health Department imposed on the hospital. We must ask how medical residents might be educated to confront institutional inhumanity of this sort instead of collaborating with it through action or inaction. If that question were answered, it might go a small way toward redeeming the suffering of all involved: the man who died, those who loved him, and the healthcare professionals who have accepted the burden of responsibility for his death. The poet William Stafford, quoted at the start of this afterword, says, "I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs but not recognize the fact." Surely this resident knew that the system was collapsing around her. As she rushed frantically from bed to bed, she must have been aware of the human cost that might be extracted from her patients, their kin, and herself. What kept her playing her role as an obedient underling in this tragedy instead of speaking truth to power? What kind of action might she have taken to bring reinforcements running? Is there a moral equivalent in the workplace to sending up flares, sounding the alarm, blowing whistles, raising holy hell? And what does it take to act this way in the moment while there is still something to be salvaged instead of waiting for a review board to ask what went wrong? Of course, we might view the resident as another victim of the system, the pawn of superiors whom she could not confront because they had power over her career. That is how many of us excuse ourselves from workplace lapses of morality. But if we give her a moral pass on these grounds, we fail to honor the heart of the healer in her, to say nothing of failing to honor the man who died and the family and friends who must go on without him. Not just the system failed in this case. The heart of the healer failed as well, a heart that surely knew what was occurring but refused to recognize the fact. And it is the heart of the healer, not the system, that education has the best chance to touch and transform. What caused heart failure in this resident, apparently leaving her with the sense that she had no option but to play the stacked hand she had been dealt? Can we think of her not as a victim, but as a moral agent uniquely positioned to challenge and help change the institution before, during, and after the moment of crisis? If so, what might happen in residency programs to support the healer's heart and the courage to follow it when the conditions under which medicine is practiced threaten the heart's imperatives? And how can questions like these be asked about education of every sort, at every level, as we prepare students to work in institutions that so often prove toxic to their deepest values? The individual and the institution. Let that medical resident serve as Exhibit A in my case for educating a new professional, by which I mean a person who not only is competent in his or her discipline, but also has the skill and the will to resist and help transform the institutional pathologies that threaten the profession's highest standards. I know of no field where the new professional is not needed. Medicine may capture our attention because institutional deformations can lead to the high drama of physical death, but deaths of other sorts are everyday events in most professions. The life chances of poor children approach zero when schools are more responsive to the rich and fail to encourage and support good teachers who are dedicated to educating the poor. Clients seeking simple justice find that money, not law, is the best defense, and lawyers who want to devote themselves to pro bono work find it difficult to sustain their vocations. Clergy who want their faith communities to side with the dispossessed sometimes find their goals and souls thwarted by institutional demands for members and money, pressured to lead more like CEOs than pastors, prophets, or priests. Behind my call for a new professional who can confront, challenge, and help change the workplace are two important realities. First, the large and complex institutions of our society are increasingly unresponsive to external pressure, even on those rare occasions when a well-informed and well-organized public demands change. I am haunted by the image of that organ donor's wife telling anyone she could find that her husband was sinking fast, pleading time and again for help, and time and again being ignored. Let her represent the public at large, whose cries about the failures of healthcare, education, and the major institutions of government fall largely on deaf ears, a public that lacks the knowledge necessary to get leverage on social change. And let that surgical resident and her colleagues represent all the insiders who could make a difference if they had the skill and the will to pull the levers of transformation. I am not suggesting that the public could relax if more doctors, teachers, lawyers, and accountants became internal change advocates. Professionals willing and able to play that role will always be in the minority. Most will continue to lie low because they fear reprisals or are so overworked that they lack time and energy for advocacy. A vigilant public that speaks truth to power will always be needed. And every professional who is willing to speak up needs public support, just as the public needs that person in order to achieve its goals. In our time, when the public is far too relaxed or resigned, in part because our society increasingly undermines any semblance of public life that might threaten the hegemony of power, the presence of internal change agents who heed and need the public could help revive our fading sense of citizenship. The second reality behind my call for a new professional is less strategic, more philosophical, and easily as important as the first. At the heart of every profession is an implicit affirmation that the mission of the profession must never be confused with the institutional structures in which it is pursued. The fact that we have schools does not mean we have education. The fact that we have hospitals does not mean we have healthcare. The fact that we have courts does not mean we have justice. The fact that we have churches, synagogues, and mosques does not mean we have faith. This iconoclasm does not come from cynical outsiders, but from the roots of the professions themselves. For example, in the case of the church, clergy have been reminded for two millennia that we have this treasure in earthen vessels, 2 Corinthians 4:5. The treasure is the mystery toward which faith points. The earthen vessel is, among other things, the institutional church, whose function is to codify, present, and propagate the faith. When the vessel distorts or obscures the treasure, the professional's highest calling is to reshape the clay. But the clergy who lead the church are often too inclined to ignore this part of their tradition, just as professionals in other fields ignore its secular equivalents. The earthen vessel becomes an end in itself, and protecting it and one's place in it becomes more important than living out the core values the vessel is meant to convey. We need professionals who are in but not of their institutions, whose allegiance to the core values of their fields calls them to resist the institutional diminishment of those values. Educating the new professional. What would the education of the new professional look like? How might we prepare students at every level of education to be teachers, lawyers, physicians, and clergy to say nothing of parents and neighbors and citizens, who can challenge and help transform the institutions that hold such sway over our lives. True to the spirit of this book, I am not going to explore techniques of organizational development. Such knowledge is valuable, but it is secondary to the inner landscape questions that interest me most. How can education help professionals keep their hearts alive in settings where people too often lose heart? What might help them stand up to and sometimes against the institutions from which their paychecks and perhaps their identities come? I have 5 immodest proposals regarding the education of a new professional. 1. We must help our students debunk the myth that institutions possess autonomous, even ultimate power over our lives. 2. We must validate the importance of our students' emotions as well as their intellect. 3. We must teach our students how to mine their emotions for knowledge. 4. We must teach them how to cultivate community for the sake of both knowing and doing. 5. We must teach and model for our students what it means to be on the journey toward an undivided life. I want to examine these one by one. 1. We must help our students uncover, examine, and debunk the myth that institutions are external to us and constrain us, as if they possess autonomous powers that render us helpless, an assumption that is largely unconscious and entirely untrue. We professionals, who by any standard are among the most powerful people on the planet, have a bad habit of telling victim stories to excuse our unprofessional behavior. The devil, boss, rules, pressure, made me do it. We do this not only because it gives us a cheap ethical out, but also because we are conditioned to think this way. The hidden curriculum of our culture portrays institutions as powers apart from us, over which we have marginal control at best, powers that will harm us if we cross them. It is true that we may pay a price for calling institutions to account, finding ourselves marginalized, defamed, demoted, or dismissed. But as I argue in Chapter 7, the biggest price we ever pay comes not from without, but from within. It comes from violating our own integrity, from failing to live by our own deepest convictions and callings. The extent to which institutions control our lives depends on our own inner calculus about what we value most. These institutions are neither external to us nor constraining, neither separate from us nor alien. In fact, institutions are us. The shadows that institutions cast over our ethical lives are external manifestations of our own inner shadows, individual and collective. If institutions are rigid, it is because we fear change. If institutions are competitive, it is because we value winning over all else. If institutions are heedless of human need, it is because something in us is heedless as well. If we are even partly responsible for creating institutional dynamics, we possess some degree of power to alter them. The education of a new professional would help students understand and take responsibility for the myriad ways we co-create and recreate institutional pathologies. Such an education would call us to identify and examine our own shadows, as I try to do in Chapter 2, where I dissect the shadow called fear. Only when we name and claim our own shadows and become accountable for the darkness we create will we be able to evoke the better angels of our nature, inner sources of light that make both individuals and institutions more humane. Think of any great movement for social change. The Black Liberation Movement in the United States, the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, the undoing of apartheid in South Africa, the women's movement around the world. Every one of them was animated by people who had been stripped of all external power. But these apparently powerless people moved boulders by drawing on the powers of the human heart, a power no one could take from them in a disciplined and dedicated way. The new professional will know about these often overlooked chapters of the human drama, about the dynamics of the human heart, about the remarkable ways in which powerless men and women have harnessed the power within to remake our institutions and our world. 2. If we are to educate a new professional, we must take our students' emotional intelligence as seriously as we take their cognitive intelligence. We unconsciously give institutions more power than they possess because of what we are taught by this culture's hidden curriculum. But we consciously give emotions less respect than they deserve because of what we are taught by the explicit curriculum. Don't wear your heart on your sleeve and play your cards close to your vest. The message is simple. If you want to stay safe, hide your feelings from public view. And conventional education elevates this folk wisdom to the status of philosophical truth by demanding that we stifle subjectivity for the sake of objective knowledge. But philosophers tell us there is no necessary conflict between human subjectivity and objective knowledge. In fact, as I have argued from the outset of this book, knowledge emerges from a complex interplay of the inner and the outer. And common sense tells us that the history of positive social change has been made only by people who wear their hearts on their sleeves. Witness Rosa Parks, Václav Havel, Dorothy Day, and Nelson Mandela. People whose capacity to name, claim, and aim their feelings not only shaped their actions, but also attracted millions to their causes. So the education of a new professional would overturn the academy's insistence that students suppress their emotions in order to become technicians. It would help students honor and attend to their feelings, especially painful ones like anxiety, anger, guilt, grief, and burnout. Students would learn to explore feelings about themselves, the work they do, the people with whom they work, the institutional settings in which they work, and the world in which they live. They would learn that painful feelings are not signs of personal weakness, sources of shame, or irrelevant to the complex challenges of knowing, working, and living. In the case of the organ donor who died, that first-year surgical resident told the review board that she felt overwhelmed. But instead of riding that feeling into action, she apparently allowed it to shut her up and shut her down. The education of a new professional would not teach emotional distancing as a strategy for survival. Instead, it would teach students to stay close to emotions that might become sources of energy to challenge and change institutions. Academics sometimes dismiss this sort of appeal to the emotions as touchy-feely. Apparently, they imagine that disdain will settle the issue. But the notion that good pedagogy requires attention to emotions has been demonstrated time and again across half a century of educational research. How Alice in Wonderland it is when academics, who pride themselves on being guided by facts rather than fanciful feelings, blithely ignore massive bodies of research because the facts take them out of their emotional comfort zones. For an example of facts that should have settled this issue, look at education in mathematics. For a long time, it was assumed that females failed at math because their brains are structured differently from men's. Then along came a new generation of pedagogues who said, in effect, "Folks, this is a no-brainer. Females fail because they're told early on that girls can't do math, so they come to class with minds paralyzed by fear. Help them free their intellect by dealing with their feelings, and they will do as well as males." And so it has been, because many math educators, and some in the sciences, began paying as much attention to emotions as to minds. In other disciplines, attention to the power of feelings to freeze or free the intellect has been more spotty, and I know of no discipline that gives serious attention to the fact that emotions such as fear can paralyze the will as well as the mind, crimping the capacity for transformative leadership that is the hallmark of the new professional. The facts within the feelings. 3. My third immodest proposal is that we start taking seriously the intelligence in emotional intelligence. We must do more than affirm and harness the power of emotions to animate both learning and leadership. If students are to learn and lead well, we must help them develop the skill of mining their emotions for knowledge. For the most part, academic culture honors only two sources of knowledge, empirical observation and logical reasoning. But we do not live by science alone. To survive and thrive, We also rely on the knowledge embedded in our feelings. In fact, science itself begins in the hunches, intuitions, and bodily knowledge that lie behind testable hypotheses. And people who do good work of any sort, however technical, understand that not everything they need to know can be found in data points and cognitive constructs. Good teachers, lawyers, physicians, and leaders bring at least as much art as science to their work. And art is rooted partly in the affective knowledge that eludes our instruments and our intellect. But the subtext of most higher education is that emotions are the enemy of objectivity and must be suppressed. As a result, educated people tend to compartmentalize their feelings, acknowledging them in private life perhaps, but regarding them as dangerous to professional life. Professionals are supposed to be in charge at all times, or so says the myth, and we fear that feeling too deeply will cause us to lose control. So education gives us precious little experience, let alone competence, at extracting work-related information from our feelings. The medical resident who felt overwhelmed when left alone with 35 intensive care patients probably took her feeling as a sign of personal failure, which leads to guilt, panic, and paralysis. That sort of feeling may be a sign of failure, of course, but in this case, it seems clear that the resident's feeling carried at least as much information about the dysfunctions of her work setting as about her own limitations. So what might be a reasonable response to that observation? Until we realize that the capacity to translate private feelings into public issues, when warranted, has been an engine of every movement for social change. Take, for example, the women's movement, which can be characterized in part as a journey from Freud to feminism. From the late 19th century, halfway into the 20th, women's feelings of isolation, marginality, and craziness were seen as personal pathologies. Grist for the therapeutic mill if one could afford a psychiatrist. But when women began to understand that these feelings did not reveal a sick psyche, but rather carried information about a social condition called sexism, it soon became clear that their true therapy lay in agitating for social change. By translating, "I feel crazy," or "stupid," or "fearful," or "overwhelmed," "so something must be wrong with me," into "I feel crazy," "so something just might be wrong with the institution or society that I inhabit," we make it possible to extract information and energy from our emotions. The new professional needs to know how to name and claim feelings, neither denying nor being dominated by them. Discern whether and how they reflect in reality. Ask if they have consequences for action. And if so, explore them for clues to the strategies for social change. Of course, not all personal feelings yield knowledge about the world. Some really are reflections of personal rather than social pathologies. Mining our emotions for truth requires as much discipline as mining the senses and the intellect. And at the heart of that discipline is the winnowing of information in community. 4. So, my fourth proposal for educating the new professional is that we offer our students the knowledge, skills, and sensibilities required to cultivate communities of discernment. As we mine our emotions for knowledge, we need the same discipline we use to mine our observations and thoughts, communal sorting and sifting that helps us distinguish fool's gold from the real thing. Whatever our data source is, the key question is always the same. How much of what I claim to know can be verified from viewpoints other than my own, and how much of it is my projection? A disciplined process of group reflection, whether the group is a team working on a long-term problem or two people assessing a crisis, helps us tell the difference between the emotions that illumine our environment and those that reveal our own shadows. Both kinds of knowledge are valuable, but they invite quite different responses. Unfortunately, faced with the claim that feelings as well as facts must be addressed in the education of the new professional, many faculty will say, "I'm a biologist, or a sociologist, or philosopher, not a therapist, so don't ask me to be one." Fortunately, I am not making any such request. Therapy done by amateurs is usually an especially ugly form of psychological violence. But disciplined group inquiry, led by a skilled teacher, is one of the most reliable ways to extract information from data of all sorts, including emotional data. And the more experience we have with this kind of inquiry, the more likely we are to read our own feelings accurately when there is no time to summon a group, as was the case with that beleaguered medical resident. What are the disciplines of dialogue that help us discover the intelligence in our emotions? I address that question in my book, A Hidden Wholeness, The Journey Toward an Undivided Life, where I offer a detailed description of the principles and practices that create a circle of trust, my name for the kinds of relationships that facilitate deep and difficult learning. There is another reason, in addition to discernment, to teach our students how to cultivate community if we want to raise up a new professional. Every serious effort at social change requires organized groups of people who support each other in the demands of change agentry and generate the collective power necessary to make a difference. These are the communities of congruence that I write about in Chapter 7. Communities that emerge in the second stage of a movement as individuals start feeling the vulnerability that comes from living divided no more and seek the courage to keep on living that way. 5. This brings me to my fifth and final immodest proposal for the education of the new professional. We must help our students understand what it means to live and work with the question of an undivided life always before them. This means, of course, that our own lives and work as mentors must reveal what it looks like to be living that question. I do not mean that we must achieve an undivided life before we can teach about it. If that were the case, few of us would qualify, and those few would not include me. And yet, as an imperfect person in an imperfect world, I can reveal to my students what it means to wrap my life around this question. How do I stay close to the passions and commitments that took me into this work, challenging myself and my colleagues and the institution I work in to keep faith with this profession's deepest values? Living that question can mean fulfillment or frustration or betrayal by others or by oneself. Over time, it usually means all of that and more. Our students need to see how we, their elders, deal with these vagaries of fate while refusing to sell out either our professions or our own identity and integrity. And they need to see how, when we fail and fall down, as everyone does, we manage to get up again. Modeling what it means to live as a new professional also demands that we create academic programs that are open to student critique, challenge, and change. We may offer a curriculum that claims to prepare students to be change agents in some other place at some other time, but if the hidden curriculum of the program says, "Don't mess with us," the lesson our students learn is to stay safe by keeping quiet, which replicates the very problem that the new professional needs to help solve. When students go year after year as passive recipients of education, small wonder that they carry their passivity into the workplace. What they have learned at school is that keeping one's mouth shut is a way to stay safe. But they have not learned, because we have not taught them, that opening one's mouth to challenge what is wrong is a way to stay sane. The education of the new professional will offer students real-time chances to translate feelings into knowledge and action by asking questions and aiding the evolution of the program they are in. No, I am not thinking about an annual scheduled student uprising. I am thinking about an academic culture that consistently invites students to speak out about the program itself, rewards rather than penalizes them for doing so, and encourages faculty and administrators to be responsive to student concerns. An educational program that emerges from a continuing collaboration of administrators, faculty, and students is much more likely to produce new professionals than one that leaves students disempowered. The last word. Trace the word professional back to its origins, and you will find that it refers to someone who makes a profession of faith in the midst of a disheartening world. Sadly, the meaning of the word became diminished as the centuries rolled by, and today its root meaning has all but disappeared. By professional, we now mean someone who possesses specialized knowledge and has mastered certain techniques in matters too esoteric for the laity to understand, and has received an education proudly proclaimed to be value-free. The notion of the new professional revives the ancient meaning of the word. The new professional is a person who can say, in the midst of the powerful force field of institutional life, where so much might compromise my core values, I have found firm ground on which to stand, the ground of my own identity and integrity, of my own soul, ground from which I can call myself, my colleagues, and my workplace back to our true mission. An education for transformation would raise up professionals in every field who have ethical autonomy and the courage to act on it, who possess knowledge and skill and embody the highest values of their vocations. Can such an education become a reality? Yes, of course, if we who teach can think and act like the new professionals we hope to raise up. Here again is the excerpt from William Stafford's Ritual to Read to Each Other that serves as the epigraph to this afterword. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. We know what occurs in our workplaces when the values we want to profess are disfigured, distorted, destroyed. We know that we often try to fool ourselves and each other about this fact. And we know that as a result, we spend too much time lost in the dark, alone and together. The darkness around us is deep. But our great calling, opportunity, and power as educators is to shed light in dark places. In a world that needs new professionals, true professionals, in every institution, let us resist the temptation to respond with a fearful no or an elusive maybe, and allow our lives to speak a clear and heartfelt yes. This concludes the reading of The Courage to Teach, Exploring the Inner Landscape of a Teacher's Life by Parker J. Palmer. Copyright 1998 and 2007 by John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki and directed by Judy Young. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated, and was produced by Skyboat Road Company, Inc. in 2009 for Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.